Nemoto presents Addiction: Pathways That Work. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 29 minutes. Addiction care functions best when clinical pathways are coherent from first contact through long-term maintenance. Fragmented systems that separate emergency response from outpatient treatment or medical care from housing and employment supports produce predictable losses at every handoff. A practical framework links emergency departments, inpatient wards, primary care, mental health services, obstetrics, pediatrics, geriatrics, harm reduction programs, justice systems, employers, and housing agencies. The goal is not a single breakthrough but a stable sequence. Identification, stabilization, retention, and graduation into ordinary life. Each setting carries specific responsibilities that, when aligned, lower mortality, reduce readmissions, and increase the number of individuals who regain function and remain connected to care. Emergency departments often serve as the first clinical contact after overdose, infection, injury, or acute withdrawal. Consistent protocols determine outcomes. Reversal of opioid toxicity requires organized team response, oxygenation, airway protection when indicated, and appropriate naloxone dosing with observation for recurrent respiratory depression. Four stimulant toxicity, cooling, hydration, and sedation protocols reduce complications. Alcohol withdrawal requires validated severity assessment and appropriate benzodiazepine or alternative regimens with careful monitoring. These immediate actions must be paired with initiation or referral that begins stabilization, not simply discharge after vital signs normalize. Buprenorphine induction can occur in the emergency department when opioid withdrawal is present or imminent. Short, clear scripts combined with a follow-up appointment within 24 to 72 hours increase engagement. Methadone initiation or rapid referral to a program with immediate intake prevents loss of momentum. Naloxone should leave with the patient, not with the chart, and family members or companions should receive brief instruction in recognition of respiratory depression, rescue breathing, and repeat dosing. Peer navigators with lived experience, placed in emergency departments, improve linkage by addressing practical barriers that clinicians often overlook. Transportation, phone access, documentation, fear of stigma, and uncertainty about clinic hours. Inpatient wards encounter addiction in multiple forms: endocarditis, osteomyelitis, soft tissue infections, pancreatitis, gastrointestinal bleeding, withdrawal syndromes, and complications from chronic alcohol use. Addiction medicine consultation services help the primary team initiate or adjust medications, manage withdrawal without precipitating delirium, and design pain regimens that do not destabilize recovery. Hospital policies that condition antibiotic completion on abstinence place staff in ethical double binds and increase mortality. Policies that deliver full treatment while engaging patients in addiction care recognize that infection control and stabilization can proceed together. Discharge planning begins at admission. Identification of a receiving clinic, confirmation of medication continuity, arrangement of transportation, and appointment scheduling prior to discharge reduce readmissions and improve retention. Where home infusion is required, programs can assess risks and support safe completion rather than defaulting to prolonged hospital stays or insecure discharges. Harm reduction supplies can be provided on discharge when local regulations permit. Education on wound care, safer injection practices, and recognition of complications reduces avoidable returns to the hospital. Perioperative management requires coordination between surgical teams, anesthesiology, pain specialists, and addiction clinicians. Individuals on maintenance buprenorphine or methadone benefit from continuity rather than abrupt cessation. Analgesia can be achieved through multimodal strategies including regional anesthesia, non-opioid analgesics, and, when necessary, supplemental short-acting opioids with careful titration and monitoring. Clear communication prevents conflicting instructions that erode trust and destabilize recovery. Documentation and discharge summaries should avoid stigmatizing language and should include explicit guidance for outpatient prescribers to prevent duplicative or dangerous combinations. Primary care is the stable platform where screening, diagnosis, treatment, and prevention intersect. Universal, brief screening for alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use identifies risk early when combined with nonjudgmental questioning and clear next steps. Prescription monitoring program data should appear within the electronic record at the moment of prescribing, with alerts for high-risk combinations such as opioids with benzodiazepines or sedatives, and for cumulative morphine equivalent doses above locally accepted thresholds. For alcohol use disorder, medications that reduce reward or block receptors should be offered in conjunction with counseling and support. For opioid use disorder, maintenance with buprenorphine in primary care increases access and normalizes treatment. Slow benzodiazepine taper protocols with cross-titration strategies, sleep interventions, and anxiety treatments reduce withdrawal-related destabilization. Pain care in primary settings should shift emphasis from relentless pursuit of zero pain toward improved function, mobility, and quality of life, using physical therapy, occupational therapy, non-opioid pharmacology, sleep optimization, and patient-defined goals. Co-occurring mental health conditions are not exceptions but norms. Depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, and attention deficit syndromes often precede or emerge alongside addiction. Parallel but isolated treatment tracks produce contradictions and missed opportunities. Integrated models align psychopharmacology with addiction medications and time psychotherapy to match stages of change. Suicide risk increases during transitions, especially after discharge from hospitals, jails, or residential programs. Routine, structured risk assessments combined with rapid follow-up and access to crisis lines that connect to clinicians rather than only to volunteers reduce the period of vulnerability. Clinics should specify protocols for managing co-prescription of benzodiazepines in patients on opioid agonist therapy, weighing risks and benefits openly and documenting plans that include overdose prevention and regular reassessment. Obstetric and perinatal care requires clear departure from punitive traditions. Screening for substance use in pregnancy should be universal, confidential, and non-punitive to avoid deterrence from prenatal care. Maintenance medications for opioid use disorder stabilize physiology, reduce relapse, and improve neonatal outcomes compared with unsupported abstinence. Delivery planning includes neonatal monitoring for withdrawal, with emphasis on non-pharmacologic soothing techniques and rooming in that supports bonding. Breastfeeding guidance reflects current evidence about medications and risks rather than blanket prohibitions. Coordination with child welfare agencies should prioritize family stability and safety plans over automatic separation absent immediate danger. Postpartum overdose risk is elevated and requires scheduled follow-up with addiction clinicians and primary care, along with naloxone distribution and counseling that includes partners or trusted family when appropriate consent is in place. Pediatric settings encounter the downstream effects of adult addiction and the early signs of adolescent use. Pediatricians and school-based clinicians can offer confidential screening, brief interventions suited to developmental stage, and referral pathways that do not rely exclusively on justice systems. Education for families about safe medication storage, disposal of unused prescriptions, and recognition of counterfeit pill risks reduces accidental exposure and initiation. Adolescents benefit from programs that combine family therapy, school coordination, peer support, and flexible clinic hours. Legal frameworks should protect confidentiality while allowing inclusion of caregivers who provide transportation, housing, and daily support. Geriatric addiction has distinct features. Polypharmacy increases the risk of interactions, sedation, falls, and confusion. Chronic pain and insomnia are common and often managed with medications that enlarge risk when combined with alcohol or opioids. Social isolation, bereavement, and role loss function as drivers of use in this age group. Screening in geriatric clinics and home-based primary care can identify patterns of risky use. Tapering requires slower pacing due to physiological changes. Non-pharmacologic sleep interventions and daytime activity plans reduce reliance on sedatives. Collaboration with caregivers and home health aides supports adherence and safety without stripping autonomy. Palliative care teams can address late-life suffering directly, reducing the impulse to manage distress solely through sedating medications. Justice systems hold significant leverage in directing trajectories toward stability. Police departments can implement deflection models that route eligible cases of possession or public intoxication to services rather than jail. Prosecutors can expand diversion programs that emphasize rapid access to medication and counseling instead of prolonged supervision for low-risk cases. Courts can integrate clinicians into problem-solving dockets to reduce sanction-heavy approaches that escalate consequences for relapse rather than addressing it clinically. Jails and prisons should offer opioid agonist therapy, continue community-initiated medications, and coordinate post-release appointments, transportation, and identification documents. Suspension or termination of benefits during incarceration leads to gaps after release. Automatic reinstatement processes reduce delays and associated risks. Community supervision conditions should be crafted to avoid conflict with treatment attendance and medication schedules. Each measure acknowledges that untreated addiction is a public health risk that returns to neighborhoods. Treatment during custody and continuity after release reduce that risk. Housing policy strongly influences addiction trajectories. Individuals without stable housing face increased exposure to violence, weather, and infection, and reduced control over setting, storage of medications, and access to private space for telehealth visits. Housing first models that provide shelter without abstinence preconditions reduce emergency service use and increase treatment retention. Recovery housing supports others who seek substance-free environments. Oversight ensures that house rules protect residents while avoiding arbitrary or exploitative practices. Coordination between shelters, harm reduction programs, and clinics allows medication deliveries, follow-up visits, and mobile services to reach residents where they live. Eviction policies for lapse should be replaced with structured responses that pair accountability with re-engagement. Landlord partnerships and mediation services reduce churn that destabilizes recovery. Infectious disease care must be embedded in addiction systems. Routine testing for HIV, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and sexually transmitted infections should be offered in clinics serving individuals with addiction. Immediate treatment for hepatitis C in accessible settings prevents transmission and improves liver outcomes. Vaccination against hepatitis A and B and other indicated infections reduces outbreaks. Endocarditis, osteomyelitis, and abscesses require coordinated care that respects patient goals and recognizes barriers to prolonged hospital stays. Outpatient parenteral antibiotic therapy can be adapted with safeguards to minimize line tampering and ensure completion. Wound care teams linked to harm reduction programs decrease hospitalizations by treating early infections before they evolve into emergencies. Dental care is essential. Untreated dental disease fuels chronic pain and predisposes to relapse through the search for relief. Integration of dental visits into care plans acknowledges that oral health is part of recovery, not an optional adjunct. Data and measurement turn aspiration into accountability. Programs benefit from dashboards that display access, retention, mortality, emergency department utilization, hospital readmissions, infectious disease markers, housing stability, employment, school attendance, and family reunification. Disaggregation by age, gender, race, language, and geography reveals inequities and allows targeted correction. Risk adjustment recognizes that clinics serving higher acuity populations should not be penalized for accepting complex cases. Overdose fatality review teams bring together public health, coroners, clinicians, and community organizations to study deaths in context and recommend system changes. Rapid reporting of cluster events allows messages to reach neighborhoods where supply has changed or contamination has been detected. Measurement should feed decisions about funding, staffing, hours of operation, and partnerships rather than existing as a parallel exercise. Workforce development determines capacity and quality. Clinicians require training in addiction medicine, trauma-informed care, motivational approaches, and culturally responsive practice. Peers with lived experience need formal roles, supervision, and career ladders to stabilize programs and reduce turnover. Case managers need caseloads that permit meaningful contact and the authority to solve problems that derail appointments, such as transportation vouchers and childcare coordination. Outreach workers need field safety protocols, durable equipment, reliable communication, and debriefing structures to mitigate burnout after critical incidents. Administrators must align compensation with local labor markets. Programs that rely on goodwill alone churn staff and lose continuity, which patients experience as abandonment. Partnerships with universities and community colleges can build pipelines for clinicians, counselors, and peer specialists, with loan forgiveness and stipends targeted to underserved regions. Ethics and rights should be explicit rather than assumed. Consent processes must be understandable and documented. Privacy protections should be respected while enabling coordinated care through appropriate consents and data sharing agreements. Policies that withhold medications as punishment violate standards and increase risk. Involuntary holds require careful thresholds and time-limited plans that connect immediately to voluntary treatment once imminent danger resolves. Pregnant patients deserve non-punitive pathways that keep families intact whenever safety allows. Youth require confidentiality balanced with parental involvement that supports care. Hospitals should replace stigmatizing signage and scripts with language that emphasizes dignity and partnership. Security protocols should protect staff without criminalizing illness. Technology reduces friction when designed with clinical workflows in mind. Electronic records should embed clinical decision support at points of care, flag dangerous combinations, and automate reminders for follow-up appointments. Prescription monitoring data should appear contextually, not as a separate login that consumes scarce minutes. Telemedicine expands reach and reduces missed visits for individuals balancing work, caregiving, mobility challenges, or long distances. Secure messaging between clinics and pharmacies prevents gaps in dosing and clarifies substitutions when supply shortages occur. Overdose detection devices and smartphone applications create safety nets for those who use alone, prompting emergency contacts if motion or breathing ceases. Data systems should allow near real-time alerts about toxic supply and should support direct outreach from clinics and harm reduction programs to affected neighborhoods. Financing shapes behavior. Fee-for-service models reward volume rather than outcomes and rarely pay for care coordination, peer navigation, outreach, or data analysis. Blended or value-based arrangements can tie a portion of payment to retention, mortality reduction, infection control, and housing stability, provided that risk adjustment prevents avoidance of complex cases. Coverage should include medications for opioid and alcohol use disorders without burdensome authorization. Reimbursement for telemedicine, contingency management within permitted guardrails, and integrated behavioral health expands practical options. Settlement funds from litigation related to opioids should be dedicated to sustainable infrastructure rather than short-term projects that collapse when funding ends. Financial support for housing stock, transportation contracts, and after-hours coverage sustains progress beyond grant cycles. Rural and urban contexts require different logistics. Rural regions benefit from hub-and-spoke models that connect a central specialty hub to community clinics, pharmacies, and mobile units. Pharmacy-based access to buprenorphine and naloxone expands reach where clinics are scarce. Loan forgiveness programs, housing stipends, and telehealth coverage help recruit and retain clinicians. Urban regions require coordination among hospitals, shelters, libraries, transit hubs, and neighborhood organizations. Density allows specialization but also demands communication to prevent duplication and gaps. In both settings, community advisory boards with representation from residents, clinicians, harm reduction staff, law enforcement, and local government guide adjustments and maintain legitimacy. Prevention succeeds when matched to development and context. Early childhood support for caregiver mental health, parental substance use treatment, and family stability reduces later risk. School curricula that teach emotional regulation, media literacy, sleep hygiene, and peer influence navigation equip adolescents with practical skills. Programs that provide accurate information about overdose recognition, counterfeit pill risks, and help-seeking routes outperform slogans that rely on fear. Universities and technical schools can integrate screening and referral into student health services, recognizing that transition periods carry risk. Employers can provide education that explains confidential pathways to treatment and the availability of leave and return-to-work plans, reducing concealment that ends in crisis. Public order and compassion can operate together. Disorder in public spaces requires a response, but responses built on displacement alone shift risk to hidden locations where death is more likely. Supervised consumption, robust outreach, and visible treatment access reduce public use and syringe litter while saving lives. Enforcement that focuses on violence, exploitation, and trafficking complements health-first strategies without criminalizing survival behaviors. Communication with business associations and neighborhood groups should be regular and specific about what services do, how they reduce disorder, and how to contact program leads to resolve issues. Operational reliability turns plans into lived experience. Clinics that advertise walk-in access must staff walk-in access. Programs that promise same-day starts must stock medications and secure prescriber coverage. Hotlines must be answered. Outreach vans must operate on schedules that residents can learn and rely on. Mobile teams must bring wound care supplies, naloxone, test strips where permitted, and connections to shelter and food resources. Data dashboards must update on the schedule promised, and leaders must respond to trends rather than allowing graphs to accumulate without action. Reliability builds trust, and trust builds engagement. Clinical details accumulate to create safety. Low-dose or microinduction protocols allow transition from high-potency opioids to buprenorphine without requiring full withdrawal, reducing the risk of dropout. Divided dosing addresses persistent symptoms for some patients. Methadone programs that extend hours and streamline intakes reduce waitlists that push people back into high-risk supply. Alcohol use disorder treatment with medications should be offered routinely. Where liver disease is present, regimens must be chosen and monitored appropriately. Benzodiazepine dependence requires patient pacing and recognition of co-occurring anxiety disorders. Abrupt discontinuation increases emergency visits and undermines trust. Sleep interventions that rely on behavioral routines and light exposure improve outcomes across conditions. Nutrition support addresses deficits that intensify irritability and fatigue. Exercise and physical therapy rebuild function and reduce pain without destabilizing recovery. Care transitions are critical moments. After overdose reversal, a second contact within 24 to 48 hours improves engagement. After hospital discharge, connection to a named person at the receiving clinic reduces missed appointments. After release from custody, transportation to the clinic, medication in hand, and identification documents prevent detours that end in abandonment of the plan. After residential treatment, outpatient appointments should be scheduled before discharge and coordinated with housing moves to prevent gaps. Each transition benefits from written plans that include names, dates, addresses, and phone numbers, and from a simple rule: no transition without confirmation that the next setting is ready to receive. Families and caregivers require concrete tools rather than broad advice. Programs can provide overdose response kits, guidance on safe storage of medications, scripts for boundary setting that avoid escalation, and schedules for respite. Family therapy can map roles that developed under stress: enforcer, rescuer, scapegoat, avoider, and reorganize them so that the household supports consistency. Child welfare agencies can coordinate with treatment providers to avoid punitive cycles that sever bonds unnecessarily, replacing them with safety plans, monitored visits, and gradual reunification as stability improves. Employers can support caregivers with flexible schedules and leave policies that recognize the demands of transport and supervision during critical periods. Stigma reduction is not a rhetorical exercise but a clinical strategy. Staff who use person-first language avoid conflating identity with condition. Intake forms that ask practical questions without moral judgment set a tone for the entire episode of care. Waiting rooms that display information about medications, housing, legal aid, and employment resources communicate that the clinic expects improvement and supports it. Training that addresses implicit bias and the history of discriminatory enforcement equips staff to avoid repeating patterns that have damaged trust across generations. When staff model respect, engagement increases and outcomes improve. Public communication should replace spectacle with service. Authorities and programs can publish clear instructions for obtaining naloxone, starting medication, accessing housing support, and arranging transportation to clinics. Alerts about dangerous batches should use plain language and provide immediate steps that reduce risk. Reports should include successes, reduced deaths, increased retention, improved housing stability, alongside candid acknowledgement of gaps. Communities offered only disaster narratives disengage. Communities offered a balanced picture invest in solutions. Evaluation must be built into the design. Programs should adopt continuous improvement cycles that test small changes, measure impacts, and scale successful practices. If same-day starts decline, analysis should examine staffing, supply, and intake flow. If retention drops in a particular cohort, analysis should assess appointment times, transport barriers, medication doses, and co-occurring conditions. If overdose deaths rise in a specific neighborhood, outreach should surge, and supply warnings should be issued with details about composition where testing permits. Budgets should move toward programs that improve metrics and away from programs that cannot demonstrate impact, with transparent criteria published in advance. Equity requires more than statements. Data should identify whether certain groups experience longer waits, lower doses of effective medications, higher rates of sanction, or more frequent housing loss after lapses. Corrective action may include language access, clinic location changes, targeted hiring, and training focused on cultural safety. Equity reviews should occur on a regular schedule and should result in adjustments that are communicated to the community. Unequal systems produce unequal outcomes. Acknowledging this openly allows deliberate redesign. Sustainability depends on aligning incentives with goals. Treatment providers perform better when contracts reward retention and functional gains rather than throughput alone. Harm reduction programs stabilize when funding recognizes the value of overdose reversals and infection prevention. Housing initiatives scale when rent support and case management are funded together. Data systems endure when staffed by analysts who can turn numbers into operational decisions. The underlying philosophy remains consistent. Survival first, stability next, function and meaning layered on top, with each layer supported by policy, financing, and practice. A modern addiction system does not present as a campaign of slogans. It presents as ordinary competence visible in routines. Emergency departments start medication and hand patients to clinics. Hospitals treat infections fully and arrange continuation without delay. Primary care manages addiction alongside diabetes and hypertension. Obstetric services protect mothers and infants with non-punitive pathways. Pediatric and geriatric services adapt to developmental needs. Justice systems prioritize treatment over churn for eligible cases. Housing agencies keep people indoors and connected. Harm reduction organizations prevent death and infection while linking clients to care. Employers and schools provide quiet flexibility that protects jobs and diplomas. Data dashboards reflect reality and guide action. Communities recognize progress because mournings become predictable and funerals become less frequent. This picture does not depend on perfect compliance by individuals or perfect foresight by institutions. It depends on systems that expect ambivalence, design for relapse without catastrophe, and keep doors open without drama. The measure is straightforward. Fewer deaths, fewer infections, more days housed, more days worked or studied, more families intact, and more individuals describing ordinary life rather than crisis. Where those measures move in the right direction, policy and practice align with the realities of addiction. Where they do not, rhetoric is outrunning performance and redesign is required. The work is iterative and unglamorous. It involves forms, schedules, pharmacy stock checks, van maintenance, staff supervision, payroll, data entry, incident reports, and lease negotiations. It also involves conversation, apology, boundary setting, reassurance, and persistence across months and years. Each component matters because each component touches a point where a plan can fail. A system that treats each point as an engineering problem to be solved rather than a moral drama to be performed produces stability. Stability is the ground on which recovery stands and from which communities regain equilibrium. The subject remains serious. The response becomes equally serious, visible in the daily operations of clinics, shelters, courtrooms, and households that choose competence over spectacle and outcomes over declarations.